I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Former Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter tried and failed two times to get a tax on sugary drinks passed by city council. In fact, the current mayor, Jim Kenney, voted against the tax when he was a member of council. Last week, Mayor Kenney proposed a 3 cents per ounce tax on sugary drinks, including sodas, sports drinks, and teas to pay for pre-K, for recreation centers and park improvements, community schools, a jobs program, and money for the city's underfunded pension fund. Other cities have tried and failed to pass a tax on sugary drinks, except for Berkeley, California, although their tax is less than what the mayor has proposed. In this hour of Radio Times, taxing sugary drinks in Philadelphia, take three. And we begin our conversation with Jim Engler, Deputy Mayor of Policy and Legislation for the City of Philadelphia. Jim Engler, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. It's nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And let me give out that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jim, this, as I said in my introduction, two times, this has not been able to get through council. What is different in 2016 that makes the current mayor think that this will pass?
Well, when you look at the previous attempts, the first attempt when Mayor Nutter first suggested possibly taxing sugary drinks, it was couched as an anti-obesity measure. And the second time it was to plug a hole in the city's budget. Whereas when Mayor Kenney proposed this last week and in our discussions, it's been to fund some significant initiatives, like you mentioned, expansion of access to quality pre-K, an expansion of community schools, you know, funding significant investments in the city's park, rec, and library civic infrastructure, and also some energy improvements to all city infrastructure. And then finally, a small but significant contribution to the city's pension fund, which shows our creditors and the rating agencies that the mayor, you know, takes the pension fund issues very seriously.
Is there no other source of money that the administration, the mayor, looked at? Is it looking strictly at sugary drinks?
Well, we looked, you know, as part of the transition process and as part of the budget process, we looked at a range of options. You know, when you look at the things the city has done over the past 5 or 6 years, you're talking about 4 property tax rate increases in addition to the raising of property taxes through AVI. You're talking about increases to the use and occupancy tax, increases to the sales tax. So there's been a number of things that have happened since the attempt for a tax on sugary drinks. And when we looked at a bunch of the revenue options, this was the one option that raised enough revenue to fund the transformational change that the mayor has talked about, and also doesn't affect a large number of taxpayers the same way that a property tax increase would.
Should we think of this as a kind of sin tax? We know there's tax on liquor in Philadelphia. Are there some lessons to be drawn from that tax?
Well, when you look at the liquor tax when that was instituted in the 90s, it didn't have a large negative effect on businesses. I mean, the city's restaurant and bar scene has only gotten better since the institution of that tax. I don't know that I would necessarily classify it as a sin tax as much as it allows for choice for consumers. And it's debatable as to whether, you know, a tax like this would actually be passed along to the consumer or, you know, the tax would be paid by some other point of the production line, whether it's coming from, you know, the large soda companies down to the bottlers, to the distributors, whomever. But it does allow for consumer choice, and consumers can choose to choose a different beverage if they want to choose water or choose a non-sugar sweetened drink.
But are you saying that with this tax that would not result in higher prices if people wanted to drink a sugary drink in Philadelphia?
I think it remains to be seen. When you look at what happened in Berkeley, the early reports from Berkeley show that only about half of the tax was actually passed along to consumers. Some of the tax was you know, in other parts of the line and came out of the margins from other parts of the production line. I think it probably could lead to at least a little bit of an increase, and then it's a question of whether that changes the behavior or not. I don't know enough as not an economist.
We'll probably be picking up on that a little bit later in the hour, but it's a much smaller tax in Berkeley. And as I understand it, the argument that the Berkeley government made was this was about health and not necessarily about raising money. You're saying in Philadelphia it's really the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest portion and the reason for doing this tax is because we need to make transformational changes to what we do. Continuing with the status quo is just not an option. We need to make sure that, you know, our 3- and 4-year-olds are better prepared to enter the education system. When you talk about the additional $400 million that the city now provides to the school district every year, we need to make sure that our kids are prepared to learn when they get to kindergarten and get to first grade. And we need to make sure we're taking care of our neighborhoods, whether that comes from community schools and ensuring they have the social and behavioral services that kids need, or ensuring that we're investing in our park, rec, and library infrastructure that's used by everyone. That's really the impetus behind the tax. If there are health benefits that come from that, I think we'd be happy that Philadelphians are healthier, but this is more about raising revenue to fund those projects.
Do you know how much a liter, let's say, liter bottle of Coke or Pepsi, what that might cost if this tax were to pass?
Well, it really depends on what happens at the rest of the production line. The tax itself is levied at the distributor level. It's not levied at the retail level. So the distributor would be responsible for remitting the tax back to the city. And then it really depends on what the soda companies decide to do with the prices, if they want to reflect the prices at the consumer level with the tax or not, or if the tax is spread out, like I said, across the rest of the production line. So I don't really want to say exactly what will happen to the price.
There are several arguments against the tax, and we'll probably hear more of them a little bit later on in the hour. One is that it hurts low-income residents in the city. If they want to buy a sugary soda or a sugary drink, they're going to probably pay more. There's also the argument that this would hurt jobs. What is your counter-argument to that?
Well, I think that's a false argument. When you look at the way that the soda companies have diversified their product portfolio over the past several years, consumption of sugary drinks nationally is down about 25%. Locally, it's down just in the past 6 years about 16%. And you're seeing companies diversify their portfolio, whether it's non-sugar sweetened drinks or diet drinks, or even, you know, the increase in bottled water. So when it comes to, you know, delivery and Teamsters and bottling, you know, all of those jobs are still going to be there because they're still going to make the drinks, and they just may not be sugar sweetened drinks at the large amount that they are now. But I don't think the jobs are going away because you're taxing one part of what is a diverse product portfolio.
How are you going to counter the lobbying coming from the industry? I'm looking at something my colleague here, Dave Davies, wrote on his blog at Newsworks. He says an analysis of campaign finance reports show that in 2015, 15 current council members got a total of $68,550 in industry-related donations, and another $5,000 went to unsuccessful council candidates. How does the administration propose to counter that kind of influence and leverage?
Well, I think you saw last week, if you were able to tune in to the mayor's budget address, that there are significant groups on the side of the tax this time, which I don't think really existed last time. You know, there are a large number of Friends of groups that support the park, rec, and library system. There is a large need in the city for quality pre-K, and there are a number of people that are active in those discussions. So you're going to see a significant lobbying campaign on both sides. I think the one side will be funded by, you know, the large soda companies and the American Beverage Association coming into the city. And the other on the side for the tax is going to be much more about the grassroots and actual Philadelphians who want to see investment in their neighborhood.
Let me get John from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. So my question is how you would balance any health benefits from this tax with really the regressive nature of a sales tax that ultimately impacts disproportionately low-income consumers.
Which is something we touched on earlier. And Jim, I think this is one of the questions that sort of hangs over a discussion of this, which is that there is a potential, I guess, for health benefits if people stop drinking high calorie, low nutrients, sugary drinks.
Yeah, so I think it's really two parts, right? When you look at the way that the soda companies target and market their drinks, they target, you know, the high calorie sugary drinks at low income communities the most. So that's where consumption is the most. But when you're talking about the revenue from this tax, it's all going to stay in those communities, whether it's funding high quality pre-K seats in areas of need, or it goes into improving our infrastructure that is also going to improve health outcomes, because when kids are more active and they're you know, playing basketball in a gym, or they're running on a track, or they're out in a park, it's also going to improve health outcomes that way. So with all of the money from the revenue from this tax staying in Philadelphia and its neighborhoods, I think you're going to see health outcomes, whether it's people consuming less sugary drinks or people being able to access their community infrastructure in a better way.
Is this, though, a stable source of income if people decide, you know, I just can't afford a liter bottle of a sugary soda, that they will then switch to an alternative that doesn't get taxed at this level? Can the city rely on that kind of source of funding?
Yeah, so that's something that the finance department, the revenue department has definitely taken into account with their projections. Right now, the projected fall off is significant in the first year, and then kind of levels off. And they've looked at data from the Red Center in Connecticut and some other places, and have come to the conclusion that there will be consumption drop off. That's unavoidable, but it is a stable source of revenue going forward, and they're confident in that.
So, what is the deadline looking forward? What are some of the periods which this will come up for discussion or debate, or what's the deadline for the administration?
So we're going through the budget process right now. City Council hearings begin at the end of this month, and then we'll go through a process in April and May, and then come to a final conclusion and a vote most likely in early June with the passage of the full budget.
And assuming it gets passed, and I know there's some big hurdles there, how much of that money would go to pre-K, and when would some of that money be invested in school programs to get kids this early education?
So the tax itself would go into effect, according to the legislation that was introduced last week, the tax itself would go into effect on January 1st. So some of that money would start beginning to flow early in 2017, and we'd start enrolling kids in quality pre-K centers across the city. You'd see the city do a bond issue to fund the park, rec, and library infrastructure, and we'd have our first community schools up and running, providing services to kids later this year and in the early part of 2017.
And Jim, we're almost out of time here. Why has Jim Kenney changed his mind about a soda tax?
Well, when you look at the arguments last time, I think the mayor's made it clear that the arguments that this was going to tackle obesity or to plug a budget hole weren't significant enough. And when you look at the transformational programs that this revenue would fund, it wasn't an issue for him. He realized that if we're going to change the way that Philadelphia operates and really provide for our citizens the way we need to, this was the way to go.
Well, Jim Engler, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Deputy Mayor for Policy and Legislation for the City of Philadelphia. We've got two guests waiting in the wings talking about a proposed soda tax on sugary drinks in Philadelphia. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco, and just a recap here. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney introduced a sugary soda tax last week to raise money for pre-K and other city programs. The question is, will this tax meet the fate of other soda tax proposals and go down in defeat? Could increasing the cost of sugary drinks lead consumers to choose a healthier alternative? Is it a smart policy to use this tax to pay for city programs and services? Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Lauren Vitas. She's an attorney who represents the Philadelphia Beverage Association and the group Philadelphians Against Higher Grocery Taxes, also a former city official. And Lauren Vitas, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us by telephone is Jason Block. He's an assistant professor and associate director of the Obesity Prevention Program of the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School, Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute. And Jason Block, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
And to our callers, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Lauren, let me pick up on a couple of things that Jim Engler just said. One is, and raising the question for the critics of this proposal, is how can you be opposed to a tax that raises money for things like pre-K and other community schools and other programs that directly affect people living in the city?
Right. And I actually think all of the proposals that the mayor has put forward are extremely worthy. Obviously, pre-K has been a huge issue in the city, and education remains one of the top issues. The importance of those programs makes it all the more important that we fund them with a steady and sustainable and reliable funding source. SOTA taxes have been rejected across the country in over 40 different cities. This is a new – it's essentially an experimental funding source, and it's based on a funding source that is designed to go down over time.
Because the idea is people might not want to drink this stuff if it costs too much.
I think the three big issues around the mayor's proposal are, number one, the amount of the tax. We're talking 3 cents per ounce per drink. So a person that would go into the store and buy a 2-liter soda for $1.80 is now looking to pay an extra $2 on top of that. So you're proposing a tax that costs more than the product itself. That's going to have a tremendous impact on consumption patterns. And notwithstanding the mayor's assertions that, oh, people will just drink other things, we've only seen this tax passed in one other city, Berkeley. There's just not enough information out there to be able to predict that accurately. And to propose $1 billion of new spending based on something you don't know the impact of is questionable.
And I do want to get Jason Block in on the conversation. But are you saying, and I realize you don't work for the city, but if not this tax, I mean, as you said, I think everyone agrees these are all worthy programs. The question is, where do you go to get that money?
Right. And as a Philadelphian, like I sympathize, I understand, but it's hard to take that assertion seriously that there's just no more money out there, that we're not already, we have one of the lowest collection rates in taxes across the country of any municipality in terms of money left on the table every year. This was a city where last year, PGW, a company came in, was willing to spend $2 billion and raise $500 to $700 million for the city in cash, and the city couldn't even have a hearing on it. So it's a little tough to swallow the idea that, oh, we've tried everything, so we're going to go after, we're going to try to do a sugar sweetened beverage tax. And I think we need to be clear, too. This is – the mayor's making it sound like this is going to be paid by distributors and bottlers. This is going to be paid by taxpayers. There's just no way that the production line can absorb the cost. It's going to be paid by people living in low-income neighborhoods that drink these beverages. This is a regressive tax, and those are the folks that are going to pay for it.
Jason, let me get you in on the conversation. You're a bit of an outsider here. We're talking about Philadelphia, but I'd be curious about your perspective on just sugary drinks and the amount of sugar in these drinks and the increasing number of drinks that seem to have more and more sugar. Can you paint that picture for us?
Yeah, I mean, over the last several decades, we've seen a massive increase in consumption of sugary drinks. What you just referred to was that recently we've seen a reduction in that. But if you compare the amount of sugary drinks that are consumed now to the 1970s, it's probably double. And this is especially true of some lower-income communities where consumption is especially high, and it's clearly true for young adults and teenagers, where we see consumption of these drinks making up about 12 to 13% of all calories that these people consume. So we're talking about 300 calories a day on average for young adults and teenagers consuming sugary drinks, which is a really high amount. So it's been a major contributor. Based on all evidence that we have, it's been a major contributor to the rise in obesity rates around the country.
So are you in favor of taxing sugary drinks in order to change behavior to get people to make healthier choices?
Well, I think what I'd say is I'm an advocate of anything that can be used to decrease consumption of these drinks, which I think is a major contributor to health problems. And I think a tax is one way to do that. We've seen pretty clear evidence that if you tax beverages like this, there's expected to be a decline in consumption. And what was just mentioned is that one of the concerns is that this decline in consumption may not lead to a stable revenue source. From the public health perspective, that's actually a positive development, which is that consumption would decline to a point where it's less of a contributor to these chronic health conditions that we see.
We see also see this phrase, you know, big soda, which makes us think of things like big tobacco. Jason, from your perspective, do you see that as not one and the same necessarily, but as having parallel missions or objectives?
Well, I'm not sure that they're the same in that sense, but clearly the soda companies have been very effective in their marketing techniques over decades, and they have driven consumption rates to the point where they're major contributors to health conditions. And what I'd say is if you think about all food products that can be targeted with a tax, sugary drinks are major contributors to calorie intake, and they have almost no nutrient value to diet. And so it's one of these things where if we can target one particular food type, beverages are the thing that probably contribute the most to weight gain of any kind of food product over the last few decades. And it's something that we don't need.
Do you want to respond to that, Lauren, at all?
I'm happy to, but I think, you know, the point was to debate the sugary, the tax, and the mayor's made it clear this isn't about health for him. This is very much about a revenue grab. So, you know, that's...
What you're saying is that what the mayor is talking about is getting money for programs. The health issue is kind of a
right.
side issue.
And I'd also point out, too, consumption has been dropping steadily and obesity rates continue to rise in this country. So to pin a significant portion of the rising obesity rates and those health issues on data based on soda consumption, it's just they're going in opposite directions right now. So I think there's got to be a more detailed conversation about what is really driving this, because consumption rates are dropping rapidly.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Lauren Vitas. She's an attorney representing the Philadelphia Beverage Association and a group called Philadelphians Against Higher Grocery Taxes. Also with us, Jason Block, and he's an assistant professor, associate director of the Obesity Prevention Program of the Department of Population Medicine. That's at Harvard Medical School, Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute. Getting two interesting perspectives on this proposal here in Philadelphia coming from the new mayor to tax sugary drinks. And we began our conversation talking with Jim Engler, deputy mayor of policy and legislation for the city of Philadelphia. We want to hear from you, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Excuse me, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Steve from Coatesville to join us. Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You've already answered a portion of my question. I'm in full support of the sugar tax, but I was wondering why it's not extended to the rest of the state and why it's also not extended to sugary snacks like candy bars or cakes or things of that nature.
And I mean, in certain ways, because Philadelphia has some revenue problems, and I'm looking at you, Lauren, but go ahead and give you a chance to respond to Steve's call.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think the city has gone after a lot of different types of revenue over the last couple of years. And now they've sort of run out of, you know, they said they've run out of things to tax. So they're looking at trying to create new taxes, but they're restricted by state law as to what they can tax. And I think it raises a really good issue. There's some legal questions about whether this tax is even legitimate under, you know, state law, because these are products already subject to the sales tax. It raises a big question. For the General Assembly to decide, and I don't think they would ever support a tax like this. It would need to go through the state legislature, and that's just not going to happen because this is a wildly unpopular concept.
Jason, I'm curious your response to Steve's comment, and it's true. I mean, there is sugar in sodas, but there's sugar in so many other things. Also, I'm seeing a question from Maddie. Why is only the soda industry being taxed? It's about sugar content. Why does Starbucks and Dunkin' get a pass? So I think part of the question is, it's perhaps a chance to examine just the amount of sugar in our diet and also right. the potential health consequences.
Yeah, some people have proposed putting forward a tax on junk food, for example. The best evidence we have about these types of taxes is now from Mexico. Mexico implemented roughly a 10% tax on sugary drinks, and they also did an 8% tax on junk food. Most of the tax proposals in the United States have really been focused on drinks rather than more broadly on other junk food products, candy, things like that. And one of the things that public health advocates point to is that sugar in drinks seems to have a uniquely negative impact on weight because of the limited compensation for the calories that are consumed in liquid form. So when you drink a sugary soda, a 20-ounce Coke, for example, might be 240, 250 calories. Our bodies don't really register those calories as significant intake. We're very efficient at absorbing sugar in liquid form so that soon after drinking it, it's not as if you ate something and you feel full. Mm. That sensation passes very quickly with drinks. And so from a public health perspective, people have been focused more on sugar in drinks because it seems that that contributes more to calories than sugar in food products, for example. And that's not to say that we haven't had a major increase in the total amount of sugar consumed, and that's had a negative impact on chronic disease rates around the country, but the liquid seems to be worse in that regard.
And I was reading that in a 20-ounce serving or, I guess, bottle of sugary soda or sugar drinks, it's 16 teaspoons of sugar per 20 ounce. Do I have that right, Jason?
That's right. That's right. So it's a huge amount of sugar that you consume in a manner that's where the sugar is almost immediately absorbed into the body. And so that calorie intake is immediately put on.
Let me get Ben from looks like Port Richmond to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Ben. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi there. I totally agree with the attorney. While I know she's representing an interest in this, as a resident of the River Wards, an underserved working class community, you know, in Philadelphia, I have to point out the fact, having lived in other cities like Washington, New York, and Los Angeles, that we are the highest per capita, highest ratio of taxation per citizen than anywhere in the country, with probably the weakest and lowest civil law enforcement in the country. Our sheriff doesn't collect money. They don't foreclose on houses. There are tons of abandoned houses in the city. And the fact that they're looking at adding another tax based on an already taxed product, the sales tax here is very high, tells you that they're not managing the money properly and there are no checks and balances.
Well, you know what?
So go ahead.
No. It's a great question. I'm actually looking at Lauren Vitas to give her a chance to respond to your comment, something you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about $1 billion in new spending over the next 5 years. And they can all be, you know, great programs. But the question is, the first question should be, can we afford them? You know, we've essentially maxed out our credit cards and now are trying to open a new one. And that has to be looked at.
I'm looking, and I referenced this earlier, something that Dave Davies wrote on his blog about the numbers of city council members who have received money, donations from the beverage industry, Liberty Bell Beverage, PAC, Teamsters Local 830, the family of Harold Honickman. I'm just quoting from Dave's piece. I mean, it seems is the industry willing to make the same kind of investment that it made the last two times this sugary soda tax came up?
Yeah, and I do want to respond to your comment about big soda. This is the last two times this tax was proposed, it was defeated by a broad coalition, a coalition made up of residents, of small business owners, and folks in the industry. So to suggest that this is a couple of multimillionaires sitting in their McMansions in the suburbs plotting on how to destroy this city is ludicrous. It's rhetoric populist rhetoric, and it's just not it doesn't reflect the movement behind the opposition. You know, our coalition has a ton of small business owners who've seen the impact of all of the tax increases that the caller from Port Richmond mentioned. They're seeing folks who would come in to spend, to spend in their stores that have less dollars in their pockets. And contrary to the mayor's assertion that this isn't going to cost jobs, it will. The more you make it expensive to do something, the less people can do it. So
what do you make of the argument? And I'm not saying I believe it one way or the other, but the argument, which is that people will just buy sugar-free sodas, for instance, as opposed to the sugary sodas. So it doesn't really affect the distributors or the people that sell the product.
People are going to be spending – people will buy less. That is a fact. That is – consumption's going to drop because of this.
They'll go to sugar-free, for instance?
You may see some movement. Again, I don't think there's really enough data to accurately predict how people are going to react. But I can tell you that a lot more people are going to be going over the bridge to do their weekly food shopping when their grocery bills go up significantly.
Jason, do you want to weigh in on this? I mean, is there a point at which something costs so much, and if we're talking about sugary drinks, that people do essentially either drive across state borders or make that change in their behavior?
So whenever a tax like this has come up, that's been a concern, especially when the tax is at the city level. And I suppose that is a concern. There's never been any clear evidence that occurs. From the perspective of public health, declining consumption is one of the major goals of a sugar-sweetened beverage tax. So if consumption declines, that's a positive thing. And if they switch to other beverages, that's a positive thing. And what they saw in Mexico is that while the taxed beverages, which were the sugar-sweetened beverage, declined, the untaxed beverages, which was mostly bottled water, increased. And so if there's a transition from sugar drinks to non-sugar drinks, then that's a really positive thing on the part of public health. It might lead to some declining revenues from a tax over the course of time. But the tax has two purposes. One is to raise revenue. The other one is to benefit health. And if you have a greater benefit of health with some declining revenue over time, that would be perceived by the public health community as a win for the tax like this.
And that's Jason Block, who joins us along with Lauren Vitas. We're getting two fascinating perspectives on a proposed tax here in Philadelphia, a tax on sugary drinks. 1-888-477-9499. We're going to take a very short break, talk a bit more, and then we will remember Nancy Reagan. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. I'm talking with Jason Block, an assistant professor and associate director of the Obesity Prevention Program at Harvard Medical School. Also with us, Lauren Vitas. She's an attorney who represents the Philadelphia Beverage Association, talking about the proposed tax on sugary drinks in Philadelphia to pay for city programs, something the new mayor, Jim Kenney, introduced last week. Let me get, looks like Mike from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Mike, go ahead, you're on the air. Go ahead, Mike, you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead, Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, so I heard the representative, I believe, from the city saying that it would not affect any workers. But just from a working man's perspective, I don't believe all the products that they sell are manufactured in our area, so, and I believe that most of it is soda. Production lines would be shut down, maintenance people would be laid off, truck drivers that deliver the carbon dioxide to the plants, corrugated container companies would lose people. So if it's one person or if it's 10 people, the equivalents of the wage tax and the other revenues that are pumped into the city, There definitely is a chain reaction when it comes to how workers are affected out in the field. I know a lot of the conversation lately has been about the big money.
Sure.
But I would encourage the city not to make such broad and general statements to get their points across. I believe the woman from the beverage agency said, look, it's a way to raise revenue.
You know what, Mike?
Well and good.
Yeah, I got to jump in here only because you don't have the greatest phone line, and I think you made an interesting point. And I wonder, Lauren, whether you see it the way Mike does. He's talking about a massive shutdown of jobs as a result of a tax on sugary drinks were to be passed.
Yeah, I mean, there are two plants in the city. This is going to have a real impact on how those folks do business. It's a numbers game. It is math. When the math stops working out, it's going to have an impact. It's going to impact, as the caller said, folks from the guys who are making the deliveries to the people who are selling the product. It is going to have a negative impact.
Let me get Suzanne from, looks like Westchester, to join our conversation. Suzanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. My comment is just about these taxes and how they're supposed to drive behavior. If you've ever stood in a line at Wawa watching somebody buy a pack of cigarettes, I'm just agape at the price for a pack of cigarettes. It's not stopping people from consuming whatever they want. It's just overburdening them. And maybe a few people stop the behavior, but you're just burdening the rest of the people who want. Let people have their free will. Let them have their soda with the sugar. Some people might need a little sugar boost every now and then. Just find another way. I appreciate that the obesity people are trying to, you know, shape behavior, but this is a ludicrous way to go about it. It just takes away people's free will. That's my comment.
I'm glad you called in, Suzanne. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Jason, we're almost out of time here, but she does raise the cigarette question. And one wonders, even from a public health perspective, is there something addictive about sugary drinks?
There's long been a concern about sugar having some addictive properties. It's certainly not on the scale as cigarettes, but that has been a concern. And certainly it becomes a habitual thing, the consumption of these type of heavily sugar-laden products like beverages. One thing I'll say is that taxes have been quite effective at lowering cigarette use around the country, and as we've seen cigarette taxes rise, that has also precipitated a decline in the use of cigarettes. Whether it would be as dramatic with sugary soda, we don't know that yet, but certainly we would expect to see a decline in consumption with these taxes. And that would that should have really meaningful benefits on chronic diseases like diabetes and obesity, which have reached epidemic proportions. In Philadelphia, across the country, we see a third of adults have obesity and about 10% of adults have diabetes. And so these have reached crisis proportions, and we need to really try to be aggressive in terms of addressing them at the policy level. And a soda tax is one way to do that.
Lauren, we're just about out of time. What's the next move of the Philadelphia Beverage Association?
I think it's the next move is really just to educate people about what the mayor's proposal is and how it's going to impact their grocery bills. And from there, it's going to be continuing to build the broad-based coalition that we built the last two times, made up of residents, small business owners, and stakeholders. And really, that just begins with education.
Well, to be continued. I'm sure we will have at least one more, probably more, conversations about this. Lauren Vitas, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks
in Radio Times. And she's an attorney who represents the Philadelphia Beverage Association. Jason Block, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Associate Director of the Obesity Prevention Program at Harvard Medical School. Thanks very much. Well, Nancy Reagan died yesterday at her home in Los Angeles at the age of 94, reportedly of congestive heart failure. The wife of the 40th president, she was known as a fierce protector of her husband's legacy and image and was his informal advisor. President Obama said she redefined the role of first lady. We asked Jacob Weisberg to talk about her legacy and image. He's the author of a new biography, Ronald Reagan, part of the American President series from Henry Holt and Company. Jacob Weisberg is chairman of the Slate Group, former editor of Slate Magazine, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Michael Deaver, friend and aide to President Reagan, friend of Nancy Reagan as well, said, and I'm paraphrasing here, there would be no Governor Reagan or no President Reagan without Nancy Reagan. Do you agree?
Yeah, I don't think that's an overstatement at all. I think in one respect, it was Nancy was simply the person who made Reagan happy and thus able to function in his career and his professional life. Reagan wasn't close to a lot of people. I think you could argue that the only other person in his whole life he was really close to was his mother. And even Nancy said, you know, you could only get so close to Ronald Reagan. There was a kind of wall he put up. But he was hugely in love with her for their whole time together. He was tremendously dependent on her. He wrote her love letters throughout their marriage. He pined when she was away. And it's clear that at one level, she was the person who allowed him to function. But at another level, I think what she did for him was she protected him. And she helped him project the image that made him successful in politics. She was always thinking about how Reagan looked to the world, about whether people were taking advantage of him. She looked out for his interests, and at a lot of key junctures, she played a pivotal role.
Like many people, I've been seeing images of speeches that he gave or when he's being sworn in as president, and she had that look, that adoring gaze that she directed towards her husband. I mean, it seems like one of her signature movements, if I can put it that way.
You know, and she often got knocked for being inauthentic, and some people thought that couldn't have been real, that it was an act. I think it was very much real. I think she was really in love with Ronald Reagan. And even more than that, she had this instinct to take care of him. You know, that when they met in 1949, he was on crutches. He'd broken his leg at playing in a charity baseball game. And she's always seemed in a way to be a kind of both a sort of partner and a mother for him. You know, Reagan called her mommy, which
yes.
is sort of ironic in a certain way. But she adored him. You know, she had, as an actress, she was known for those big eyes. I mean, that was her kind of, you know, in the cartoon of her. Her eyes are, you know, almost as big as her head. And, you know, that was her real look towards him. But even with her own children, you know, they were envious of that relationship because they were never able to be that close to either of their parents. They weren't able to have the kind of relationship that they had that their parents had with each other.
Well, she certainly had her share of critics who didn't like the kind of excesses at the White House, her, you know, very expensive and fancy gowns, redoing the china of the White House during some hard times in this country back in the 1980s. Was she just sort of new to this world of national politics, or was that just this notion of what, entitlement?
I think there was some entitlement there. Nancy grew up in a prosperous household. Her father was a wealthy doctor. Her mother was a socialite in Chicago. And then she went into the studio system. She was a contract player for MGM in the early 1950s. And in that world, you know, the studio takes care of everything. You don't have to go. You don't have to go grocery shopping. You don't have to buy your own clothes and jewelry. And I think she did get used to a certain kind of pampering. And in Reagan's political career, you know, she cultivated this circle of wealthy friends much more than Reagan himself did. And I think she always had the attitude that someone else should pay for something. And at the same time, we talked about how she focused on Reagan's image. Mm-hmm. I think that tied into a larger concern with appearances and things being fancy and things looking right according to the standard of her wealthy friends. So, you know, I think that explains her sort of tone deafness in the expensive redecoration of the White House, in getting these very expensive dresses and jewelry as gifts, which she later claimed were loans, with the china, the very expensive inauguration they put on when Reagan was elected. It goes on and on.
Reading all the obituaries and some of what you wrote as well, Jacob, is the trauma, and one can certainly understand it, of the assassination attempt on her husband by John Hinckley, and how, I guess, in many ways that changed her. You wrote that she even tried to convince her husband not to run for re-election. Was she traumatized by this?
Very much so, and where Reagan himself got over the assassination attempt in the sense that I don't think it was going to hold him back from anything he wanted to do. He just complained about having to wear a bulletproof vest when he would make public appearances. But she really thought, she was obsessed with the idea that he was going to be assassinated and there was going to be another attempt on his life. And so, you know, she started consulting an astrologer, which I don't think had been a part of her life before, trying to figure out when, you know, the stars were in alignment for him to appear in public and when it might be dangerous. And she ended up controlling the White House schedule in many respects based on what she got from this astrologer, Joan Quigley. And, yeah, she wanted him to go back to California. She didn't want him to run. She thought the risk was too high.
And people said, don't cross Nancy Reagan. Some people did. And what happened?
Well, yes, I think the question implies the answer. You know, the thing was, Reagan himself was very conflict-averse. He was a very nice guy, and he hated firing people. And these problems would build up in the White House. The most famous one, of course, was with Don Regan, his chief Treasury Secretary and then chief of staff at the time of Iran-Contra in the second term. And everybody was sort of saying, you know, Don Regan had to go. But Nancy was the one who could kind of make her husband do something when other people couldn't. And in that case, she really almost fired Don Regan herself by leaking out that they were bringing in a replacement. The replacement was Howard Baker.
And her Just Say No campaign, I think there were a number of critics that felt like she was minimizing the difficulty of saying no to drugs. Is that her part of her legacy?
Well, that phrase will always be associated with her, of course, along with the photograph of her sitting on the knee of Mr. Key, which was part of the Just Say No campaign. Mm-hmm. I think there you have to sympathize a little bit with the predicament of the First Lady, who does not set policy, who does not get involved in legislation, who does not have significant resources to spend, but at the same time, by tradition, wants to associate herself with an important issue. And that's the issue she picked, and it was sincere. I think, you know, there's not much evidence that that campaign had any significant effect on the problem of drug addiction in the United States. But at the same time, I don't know that there's any realistic expectation that it could have, because it was fundamentally just a rhetorical campaign.
Well, when they left the White House and her husband got Alzheimer's, she was an ardent supporter of embryonic stem cell research, which, of course, is now a very controversial issue within the Republican Party. And it is interesting to think of them as we watch this presidential primary going on in the Republican Party. What do you see, Jacob? And many of them make references to Ronald Reagan.
Well, I don't think Nancy had a strong independent political ideology. People often assume that she was more liberal or open-minded than her husband on abortion, on the Equal Rights Amendment, certainly on gay rights, because they were surrounded by gay friends in L.A., and she was in New York as well in the fashion world. But I think that was one issue which went directly to what she was dealing with, caring for her husband when he was suffering for Alzheimer's for such a long time. And I think, you know, she felt strongly enough that she was willing to take a public position at odds with most people in the Republican Party.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye here, and I believe the president referenced this long goodbye, and that was, of course, the declining mental and physical health of her husband as he dealt with the ravages of Alzheimer's.
Yeah, you know, when he wrote that famous letter to the country in 1994 in this sort of spidery hand, but it's clearly him. You hear his voice in the letter saying that he has Alzheimer's, and it's really the last time you're going to hear from him on the public stage, and he knows the burden it's going to create on his family and on Nancy in particular. And that was the next 10 years, from 1994 to 2004. She both took care of him in private and kept him hidden from the public.
Well, I thank you so much, Jacob Weisberg, for joining us today on Radio Times, talking a bit about Nancy Reagan.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's the chair editor-in-chief of the Slate Group, author of several books, including a new one called Ronald Reagan, joining us to reflect on Ronald Reagan's wife, Nancy Reagan, who died yesterday at her home in California at the age of 94. That's it for the first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. In fact, hour two, waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.